Next session number 16630, Marguerite Patton, reel 4.
Marguerite Patton, reel 4. Do you remember any particular Ministry of Food campaigns and how effective they were?
Yes. Going back to my Cambridge days before I had my daughter, one of the campaigns was on jam making. The Women's Institutes, Towns, Women's Guilds, during the summer period, would ask if they would make jam for the nation, because fruit was plentiful in the form of plums and certain things, mostly plum jam. I associate plum jam with the war, because I think we must have been blessed by having wonderful crops of plums during those years, because there seemed to be plum jam, and more plum jam, rationed, of course. And I, as a senior home economist, was loaned to the jam-making groups. Now, I had a brief. Every pound jar of jam should contain 60% sugar. It was important, because if it contained 60% sugar, it will keep. And one never knew where the jam was going to be stored. You know, a little grocer might have a damp cupboard or a damp cellar or something, and it was going to be distributed throughout Britain. So this was what I had to insist on. And that was a bit of a nightmare, I must say, because you were dealing with very experienced housewives, and I had to come in and give them instructions. Now, I'm sorry, that jam is not sufficiently boiled. Rubbish, young woman. I've always made 2 pounds of jam out of 1 pound of sugar. I'm very sorry. But in order to meet the ministry's standard, you can only make 1 2/3 pounds of jam. What a waste! I'm sure it would be if it was just going into your larder. But it's not only going into your larder, it is going throughout Britain, and it must travel. So that was one campaign of which I had first-hand knowledge. There were many others, potato campaigns, potato peat. Now, that was a clever thing about the Ministry of Food, eat more potatoes. You will see in one of the books I subsequently did for the Imperial War Museum a wonderful rhyme about potato peat. And the end is, potatoes don't take up space in ships. That was the telling line. Potatoes were homegrown. They were filling. They were versatile. So potato peat became a symbol. And I was asked to write an article fairly recently by a nutrition magazine. You see, everybody's deploring children eat the wrong food. And I think that nobody's been clever enough to find symbols for the right food. Potato peat was a character. If you imagine a big oval potato with a funny little hat on his head and a cheery grin, children love potato peat. And if you said to them, now, potato peat, you know, would like you to do this, I don't say it would work every time, but it was an encouragement. So potatoes were one. Oatmeal was another campaign. They had big posters, oatmeal only, and I think it's about 2 pence a pound or something. The figure may be wrong, but it was round about that. And so we then went into oatmeal thickening stews, oatmeal biscuits, oatmeal in puddings, oatmeal coating that microscopic little bit of meat, or rather that dreary old fish that has smelt a bit tired. That was another one. Breakfast campaign, urging people to have breakfast. You see, I think they'd have liked breakfast very much, but where was the lovely bacon and egg every day? And the dried eggs had campaigns behind it to begin with, because people didn't like it to begin with. Orange juice for the children, I don't think there was a campaign. Quite hard at the beginning, because the orange juice in the bottles that so kindly came from America and was vital for young children and wonderful that they had it, it was very concentrated. So a little like the dried egg, you had to teach people how to make the best use of it. That was a very important campaign. And the people who went into health clinics from the Ministry of Food were nearly always dietitians, not so much people like myself, although I went sometimes to give the mums, you know, children recipes. But the dietitians went in to urge the cod liver oil, to urge the orange juice and the supplements and the extra milk, take it up. You see, that was a very definite ration campaign. These are your basic rations, but if you are entitled to extras, do make certain you have them. Expectant mothers had them. Young children had them. So that was the reason, I think, how children grew up strong and healthy, because they had this extra care, and it was so important that mothers gave it to them. And I think all mothers felt, again, it was their duty to do it. It wasn't a problem. To make mothers. Maybe they had been careless in the past, maybe they hadn't cared, but they cared then. They cared very much on the whole. But of course, you must remember, you're hearing just one person's side of this. It's a little like the black market. I didn't hear about the black market because I wasn't in the place. I had my definite home rations, I had my demonstration rations, and that was it. I think possibly at Harrods, I was in a lucky a position to be able to buy a better assortment of fish, unrationed. A better assortment of green grocery, maybe, unrationed. And that was typical of other people who happened to be in the right place at the right time. So from that point of view, there was a slight unfairness. But no, I cannot see any way it could have worked better. And we weren't hungry. Now, I've heard again since the war, and particularly in the last years when people are recalling these memories, oh, I knew somebody who was starved to death. Well, I'm sorry, but I didn't know them. And in fact, they should not have been starved to death because the food was adequate. And another very good thing that I feel about those years, it was sort of because of the situation, that people weren't lonely in the same way. You can imagine old people living. They had air raid wardens going up and down the road. Are you all right, Ma? Or are you all right, Mrs. Brown? Yes, I'm all right. Would you like a cup of tea with me? You know, there was this sort of feeling. So I'm sorry if people were starving, but I must sound very unsympathetic when I say they had no need to starve. The food was there. You got to buy it. One's almost talking as if the rations were handing you as a nice little present every week. They weren't. You had to buy them. And people had to balance their budgets. And remember, many people were hard up because fathers had left well-paid jobs. Some firms made up the pay. Other firms didn't. My husband's firm didn't. So that he had an officer's pay. But it wasn't princely, you know. Even when in latter years he became a squadron leader or an acting wing commander for a brief time, it certainly wasn't lordly. I went on throughout the years at Harrods right to the early 50s. My husband was flying throughout most of that time. We always feel with our fingers firmly crossed that we were a very lucky family because my husband survived over 80 raids and 3 crashes. So when he finally came, he was a voluntary reserve, he wasn't permanent Air Force, when he finally came out, we weren't allowed to fly, our daughter and I, because he said the patterns have had their share of luck in the air. And it took quite a year or so. I had to cross the North Sea to go to my sister in Norway. And jolly choppy it was, I might say. But the years in Harrods were very interesting. I wrote my first cookery book for Harrods. I wrote 3 books for Harrods. Because towards the end of the 40s, while food was rationed, appliances began to pour onto the market. I find this absolutely fascinating. We were short of food, but things like electric mixers and liquidizers, automatic washing machines, refrigerators, and the first freezers were storming into Harrods. So much so that I opened for Harrods a second bureau. The food bureau was on the ground floor among all the food departments, and then I opened on the second floor among the appliances, one for demonstrations there. I had by that time quite a team of home economists, And we demonstrated the latest washing machine, the latest liquidizer, all these things coming back. And so I saw the beginning of new appliances, which was very thrilling. But I went on with Harrods with the demonstrations, and of course I had another great thrill to appear on the second day of Woman's Hour. Now, Woman's Hour began in 1946. And I wasn't on the first day, but I was on the second day and became a very regular broadcaster. And it was live television or live radio, all of it then. And I remember the clock was just going round. I think it was 3 o'clock it began in those days, or 2 o'clock, I can't remember which. And they had a man to introduce it. And he suddenly said to me, with the clock nearly at starting point, and I was the first speaker after him, oh, Marguerite, you might just check those facts about you. Somebody gave them to me. And I looked down and saw that I was a young mother with several children. And I can imagine all the neighbours saying, I always knew there was something odd about that. But of course, they were very helpful, those Woman's Hour broadcasts. We had more time. The kitchen pump was 5 minutes, so it had to be brief, it had to be to the point, and no frills and furbelows, except perhaps if you were a radio doctor or Grandma Buggins. So one could talk at length. And they were fascinating years from my point of view in the various things people were wanting to find out. They had to wait until the 50s to really find them out properly when all food came back. But younger women hadn't had any chance to learn to cook. They'd been in the services, they were married, and now suddenly they were creating a home. And I've been asked a lot, nothing to do with food, about how women changed during those war years. I had to think quite hard about it, because I say my mind was on food, but I met a tremendous amount of people and talked to a tremendous amount of people. And I think that was the era when women who really had just been at home suddenly discovered that they were creatures who could make up their mind, who could hold a job. You see, in many cases, girls had married fairly young. They'd had some sort of job, as opposed perhaps to a career. Then husband was called up, and they were left to run the home, to balance the budget, to do a wartime job, to bring up the children. And they found they could do it. I didn't say they wanted to do it. They missed their husbands. They wanted them back. But they could do it. And I think after the war, when husbands came back and expected the little woman to go back and be the little woman, that many women thought, not me, I've enjoyed what I've done. Somebody has seen that I can hold down a big job. I can do it well. So I think they were the years when women's attitude to work, even married and with children, changed quite a lot. And while some of them were very happy to go back and stay in the home, and that was fine, many of them didn't want to. I think it was also, from what I gather, talking to people, quite a difficult time for husbands as well. They came back to be the big man, discipline the children, you know, I'll show them who's the master in the house. And, of course, the children had managed very well. They were pleased to see their father. But it was a great time of adjustment for people. And I think in everything we did, although it was mostly food, you were conscious of that, making a more social life and talking about being together. I can remember your family meals and a real family, and the man of the family will like that. Whereas we hadn't worried so much about the man of the family, we worried about the mum and the children, because we knew the fathers would probably get a jolly good meal in their canteens. And during the war years, we were very anxious that mum shouldn't give the children's meat and the rest of it to dad. You need your meat. The children need it too. So we were very anxious, without sort of causing family ructions, to point out that everybody should have their rations and eat their rations. But now we're inclined to say, well, husband's back now, I'm sure he'd like this. So my job was to try with the scarce food, which gradually became better, to give people interesting recipes, teach them basic techniques, teach them recipes from abroad. I can remember, as fat got easier, teaching people at Harrods to make puff pastry. And then the phone was beside me there, and sort of frantic phone calls. I've got to the fourth rolling and it's sticky. What shall I do? And we were doing very much more frivolous things. Friday afternoon became a baking afternoon. And from continental people, I'd learnt all about lovely yeast buns and yeast things. And so we used to make a lot of continental bunny things, which were very economical and exciting on Friday afternoon. So Friday afternoon became a very famous afternoon. Marguerite's baking this afternoon. So it was a time of change. And then I had a lovely experience. I was invited in 1947... to be the cook on the very first women's television magazine programme at Alexander Palace. And that will show you how we did things in those days. Marguerite, they said, they'd heard me a lot on Woman's Hour, we want you to do this. We haven't got a proper cooker, right? We've only got a boiling ring, right? And of course, wartime rations, you see, 47, still very tough. 46, 47 were exceptionally tough years for ration. So I made a what became very famous, my eight-minute donuts. They weren't a bit like a round donut because we only had a microscopic amount of fat, so they were almost like a fritter. But you used dried egg and a thick batter and dropped them in and fried them, then you rolled them in sugar. Oh, people thought they were wonderful. Because we haven't thought about donuts for years. Bakers could make donuts. There were a great many restrictions on what bakers could do during the war. They couldn't ice cakes. They could make donuts if they could find the sugar because it was a basic bread dough. And they might have enough oil, but really, the general public hadn't been able to make donuts. So we were beginning to emerge. And you see, though rationing was still there, you weren't going to grumble so much about meat rationing if you could get good fish. And we began to get good fish. The fishermen were coming back from the forces and catching fish. So fish became much better. Chickens began to emerge, and rabbits and whale meat, which we will say no more. And extras like citrus fruit, peaches, apricots, you know, things that some of the children had never seen. Bananas came back. And bananas came back just once in 1945. I was asked to do special broadcasts about this last year to say 50 years, the first bananas came back. The government of the time, it was a socialist government then, they'd got in the election, decreed that all children under 18 should have a banana. I think they were free, but they were entitled to one banana. And they brought a whole lot in. I think the idea was to sort of say, well, in 1945 we won the war, but things are grim, but there's a good time coming. So bananas came back. I was lucky. I had bananas at the beginning of 1948. They'd been creeping in, but you were lucky to get them. You know, you had to be at the greengrocer's first. So again, I think being at Harrods, I had a few. But my husband, I'm quite wrong about that year. It was earlier than that. My husband had gone out to West Africa as a relieving commanding officer at the end of the war. No, so it was I had some extra ones in 1945. Was I lucky? And brought back bananas from West Africa. And servicemen coming back could do that. That wasn't illegal. But for the general public, the first banana, 1945.
So would you say the war really made your reputation? You know, yes. At the end of the war, would have been very well known, I think.
Yes and no. The war established me within a certain circle. And the circle was Harrods and the radio. 47, which was after the war, began to establish me on television. And remember, there was no channel but BBC One. Philip Harbin was another very well-known name. He came before me on television. And Philip and I were great friends. And we reached an amicable agreement that Philip was the first television chef and I was the first television cook. And we were both very happy with that description. And of course, I remained the television cook on the afternoon magazine programmes right until the early 60s, regularly doing all the BBC cookery programmes. So really, you would say I became very well known the early 50s and throughout the 50s, 60s and so on. The war years was within a sort of fairly small area, but I had established a rather special place, I think, for which I was extremely lucky. I'm sure many of my colleagues in the Ministry of Food would have loved to have come to Herons, but I was the lucky one who did.
Would you say that your experience in the war laid the basis for what you did later? You know, it seems you had to innovate so much, to be so creative, to sell the ideas, and as well as create the food you were making.
I'm sure it did. I think if one has the ability to say, well, I'm glad that happened. I'm very glad I was brought up after my father died in a family where money was terribly short. It was pretty grim at the time, but my mother made fun of it all, you know, and we were never hungry, but we were jolly short of money. And therefore, I don't view being short of money. I don't want to be particularly as hard up as those days. In fact, I don't want to be as hard up as that at all. But I could face it if I were, because I knew I could cope. I think all of us who came through the war years can face shortages. And of course, now we're all getting very elderly, and it's quite difficult to pass that feeling down to other people. I'm sure I speak not only for myself, but most of the people who cooked during those years, which say that we never waste food. It was punishable, you know, by law if you wasted food. You were fined. Oh, yes, I remember when I lived in Barnet with my mother in the early days of the war, when I had my daughter, that a lady in a very respectable neighbourhood was fined 5 shillings for wasting bread. She blamed her daily woman or somebody else, but she had to pay the fine and the shame of it. Oh, dear. So those war years taught me not to waste, taught me to be imaginative, if you like. Creative is probably a better word. And if you can be creative with very limited resources, then, of course, you can go on being creative when you have a wealth of food with which to play. They taught me also that people basically are very nice. We hear about the nasty ones, but on the whole, people are nice. And I think as a race in Britain, adversity brings out the best in us. I think also, I have a horrible feeling that war brings out the best of us. I think we're a naturally fighting race who really are our best with our backs to the wall. It shows what we can accomplish. Because when you think how long you have to wait for something simple today, and yet the planes and the tanks, all these other things, came pouring out, didn't they? And you also think that most of our young men were in the forces, so it was the older people and the women who had to do it. I really think, in many ways, we are a quite unbelievable nation. But I think we've got to have a bit of our adversity to bring that out in us, because it happens all the time. Again, when the Falkland War blew up, what happened? We were ready. We were there when we had the one in the Middle East recently. We were there. The things were done. And perhaps we just need that extra kickstart to bring out the best. I mean, that really is only my personal opinion, and probably I have no right to do it. But I'm intensely proud of those years, and I never lose an opportunity to tell people about it, because I really think we did a very, very good job. Not just the Ministry of Food, and not just the people who would, like myself, who were giving information, but the average woman at home. it makes me very annoyed when I hear the criticisms. You don't hear it so much now, because we've got over that stage. But in the 50s, 60s, 70s, when I was giving big demonstrations in theatres throughout Britain, you would nearly always be interviewed by some local journalist who used to say, and of course the British women aren't good cooks, and I used to sort of fire at the poor creature, male or female, whoever it was, and say, what absolute nonsense you're talking. If we hadn't been good cooks, we wouldn't have coped. We had to be good cooks, and the average person was. Our mistake is like we grumble ceaselessly about our weather. We used to grumble ceaselessly about our cooking. Now, don't ask me why, because I think in small restaurants and cafes, the food was bad. But I think in many homes, not all, many homes, the food was excellent. And the people were jolly good cooks, not in the way they are today, sort of roaming the corners of the earth and cooking Chinese, Japanese and every other kind of food, but good traditional British food. And that takes a lot of beating when it's done very well.
From what you've been telling me, the Ministry of Food did a very good job in the war, is that right?
I think the Ministry of Food did an excellent job. Now, only recently, 2 or 3 days ago, a newspaper rang me up and asked questions about beef, and then went on about Ministry of Food. Did I think it would be a good idea if they did the same thing? And I had challenged a previous Minister of Food at a conference. It was when we heard about redundancy, and then we heard all about this, the British are so badly fed, etc. And said, well, why can you not give your message loud and clear? You see, I think the messages we have today, let's deal with the British eat badly. It's a disgrace if they do. It's a disgrace on the shoppers and on everybody else if they do, because there is absolutely no reason. Again, I've been criticised by people who say, yes, but Marguerite, if you ate well, you'd spend a lot of money. No, you wouldn't. I know citrus fruit, which is ideal, is expensive, but we hadn't got it during the war, and we had to get our vitamins in other ways, and we did it. What it needs is a sort of stirring, imaginative messages that we used to have. They didn't mind making a joke of things, the Ministry of Food. If you look up old food facts, some of them are jolly funny. It's not woe, 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 or do, do, do. It's sort of jollying people along. And I think that approach was used. I remember when I wrote for the nutrition magazine, I quoted these turtles, something sort of turtles that a few years ago, Children of the Bell, it was a film, I think. And I can't remember what kind of turtles they were. I don't think I ever saw the film. I'm sure I didn't see the film. But I did say, well, if these turtles, every child is enamoured with these something turtles, or some of these spacemen, why not harness them, as we did Potato Pete, as we did those kind of things, and get your... Children aren't going to eat the right foods just out of instinct. You're lucky if they do, because the other things they like very much. You see, we weren't necessarily virtuous during the war, but we hadn't got all these other things. 12 ounces of sweets a month was the ration. But if you had it all in a lump, it looked a great many sweets, but it had to last out, and we didn't have many other sweet things. And the ministry didn't say, ooh, sweets are bad for you, because they jolly well knew we had to have some sort of sugar. And they also, the books I've written since, contain a lot of wartime recipes for sweetmeats, because we felt we had to have something sweet, we had to have something like that. But you could lure children, quite difficult today, because they've been brought up on so much of junk food, but you could do it with imagination, and you could certainly do it to the parents. But you see, we hadn't got all these things. If a child was hungry between meals in wartime, I reckon Mum would say, we're going to have a carrot, darling. But you can't imagine many mothers saying that today. Well, there's some crisps in the cupboard. That's probably being unkind, but I'm picking up on the people who do that. There are many people who don't, whose children are healthy, and I think it's like all sweeping statements. You know, it paints the picture of the whole of the British race being unhealthy. Well, that's a load of nonsense. But there are some people who aren't as healthy as they should be, and that's a pity.
I expect you were very busy last year, weren't you? The 50th anniversary of the...
It was a wonderful year. I had a second book from the Imperial War Museum. And the first one was done in the 80s, We'll Eat Again. And that was gathering together the ministry information, some of the recipes I demonstrated at Harrods. And I'm happy to say it is still selling very well. And what is interesting, I understand that it is going a lot into schools as part of history. And that, of course, I learned when I gave the first demonstrations at the Imperial War Museum. And when you approach that for the first time and you see that huge gun, your mind thinks, oh, they're only interested in war. But that's not the case at all, is that they are interested in how we behaved in wars, we, the public.